From Nevada Public Radio, I'm Paul Boger. This is State of Nevada. Rayshawn Josiah Danette Clarence, a 25-year-old Dene man, was murdered in downtown Las Vegas earlier this year. His death remains unsolved. And tragically, he's part of the growing number of unsolved missing and murdered Indigenous women and relatives cases. It wasn't that long ago that law enforcement agencies in Nevada weren't accepting Indigenous missing persons reports. Previously, if an enrolled tribal member vanished from their community, a missing persons report would have to be filed with their tribal police. Then, a law passed during the 2023 Nevada legislative session changed that. That year, there was also legislation requiring the state to hire a tribal liaison within the Department of Public Safety to help track the state's MMIWR cases, although it's unknown just how many unsolved cases there are, given that individual tribal police track their own. And in the Silver State, there are major tribal police disparities between the different tribes. Some sovereign nations may not even have law enforcement agencies on the reservation. To bring more awareness to the crisis, Las Vegas locals met at Floyd Land Park over the weekend as part of the 5th annual MMIWR Prayer Walk, recognized nationally on May 5th, yesterday. This year, they honor the life of Danette Clarence and others. KNPR's Jimmy Romo was there. Here's that report.
Dozens wearing red took to the dirt trail at Floyd Land Park over the weekend as part of an effort to bring awareness to the missing and murdered Indigenous women and relatives, or MMIWR, crisis. Rayshawn Josiah Dennett Clarence's fiance, Shaolin Charlie, was there. She says it's been a difficult time.
There's no words to describe the feeling I have gone through. It's been a harsh 3 months. It's very traumatic for the experience I have gone through, and I do not ever want no one to ever experience this ever.
Charlie was with Dennett Clarence that night he was murdered. They were catching a concert at Oddfellows. As they walked back to their car, Charlie stopped to say goodbye to a friend. And as he walked towards the back of the vehicle, he was murdered. According to authorities, the parking lot was dimly lit, and video camera footage was unavailable. Charlie says she's still waiting for justice.
It's very sad because I don't have any closure to this.
Amanda Begay, who is also Dene, was like an auntie to Dennett Clarence. She met him when he moved to Las Vegas after graduating high school. Although she's sad about his passing, she's grateful she got to say goodbye.
I just feel blessed that we were able to bury him on his homeland versus there's people out there where they're missing or, you know, they haven't been found, so they don't have that closure.
The week surrounding May 5th is known as the National Week of Action for MMIWR. The rates of abduction and murder of Indigenous women are alarming. Homicides are the third leading cause of death among Indigenous women ages 10 through 24. That's according to the National Indigenous Women's Resource Center, with many cases linked to domestic violence, sex trafficking, and sexual assault.
Sometimes, sadly, we don't know what domestic violence looks like.
That's Deanna Blackrow, a member of the Lakota Nation and founder of the grassroots organization called Her 38 Roses. She created the organization as a way to advocate for her mother, Deborah Blackrow, who was Oglala Lakota Sioux, and was murdered by her then-husband at the age of 38.
My mother's life became more about her death. For me, I want to empower other women and what we've been through. And I think a lot of it came from us deciding that we were going to do support groups and be a part of the walks and be in community in a way of like bringing awareness. If I share my mother's story, then I have a way of, in my eyes, saving others and helping them understand. And in the process, it's healed me.
For Blackrow, greater community awareness for these grassroots organizations make it easier for individuals to seek resources and the help they may need.
This is a really tragic time, and it was important for us to make sure that they were in a safe space. The community being able to be here and help, I think, makes a big difference. And so I think today was a really good day. And that just tells me that we're bringing more awareness to the community.
After the walk, local Las Vegas Paiute dancers performed traditional dances. Although neither Dennett Clarence nor Deborah Blackrow were from the Southern Paiute or Nuuvi land, many in the community felt it was important to come together and acknowledge the long history of violence against Indigenous peoples that endures to this day. It's the same community that helped support Dennett Clarence's fiancée, Shaolin Charlie, after his death.
It's very sad, but I very have a good support system with my family, my friends, and even my own Native American community. It's very good to hear that I have strong people beside me to help me get through this experience.
The last dance was intertribal, which allows anyone to participate. Then Clarence's loved ones join the circle holding hands. And for Black Crow, it's a moment she knows her mom would be proud to see.
I do feel her spirit, and I do feel that she would be proud of what we're doing, because this is her. My mom was a strong person, beautiful person. She was very much in community. This is how and where and why I got started, because I knew that my mom would be right here. And she'd be like, yes, this is, you know, so I'd like to think she'd be proud.
Nevada currently has at least 10 MMIWR cases on the state's website. If you have any information about a case, please contact your local law enforcement agency. For more information about resources, visit knpr.org. Jimmy Remo, KNPR News.
When someone is badly injured, the race to the hospital is critical. That's because heavy blood loss remains one of the leading causes of preventable death in trauma cases. Studies show that a blood transfusion delayed for even a minute can increase the risk of death by approximately 11%. So medical experts are turning to techniques learned in war to dramatically improve the chances of survival. The idea is simple. Get blood into victims with traumatic injuries as quickly as possible. Now, a growing number of first responders in our region are starting to do more on the scene with one of medicine's most powerful tools. The Mountain West News Bureau's Rachel Cohen has more.
In the back room of a fire station, Jill Reidenauer opens a package. Printed on the side, in all caps, it reads, human blood.
The color of the blood is good.
Reidenauer is a supervisor for emergency medical services in Summit County, Colorado ski country. The clear pouch is filled with dark liquid.
It's kind of dark red purplish. There are no bubbles at the top.
Earlier this year, Reidenauer administered this kind of blood for the first time to a trauma patient in the field.
And as the blood was going in, you could just see her blood pressure improve. It was pretty neat.
The patient was stabilized and taken to the hospital.
There are times that no matter what we do, we can't help. And this is something that can give someone a fighting chance.
This is called whole blood, and it's the centerpiece of a new idea to let emergency responders give transfusions at the scene of an accident instead of having to wait until patients get to the hospital. People in serious car crashes or ski accidents can lose a lot of blood quickly. The faster they get blood, the better their chances of surviving. Laura Harwood is a former trauma nurse and helped start the Colorado Whole Blood Coalition. For decades, she says, medics were trained to give fluids like saline.
I keep referring to it as a revolution because it's an entire upending of the way that people think about it.
Whole blood is special. When you get a transfusion at the hospital, it's usually split into components like plasma or platelets. Whole blood keeps it all together, which Harwood says is better. It can help stop the bleeding and jumpstart recovery. But whole blood isn't entirely new. Soldiers used it in World War I, and it made a comeback during the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan.
As those physicians and nurses and everybody started coming back, they started saying, hey, we should look at how to bring this to civilian trauma patients.
Research followed. One study showed receiving blood before the hospital decreased patients' chance of dying by 37%.
There's no other single variable that's been associated with that strong of an impact.
The Colorado Whole Blood Coalition is working to get more fire and emergency medical services on board. 15 have launched programs in the state in the last 2 years. First responders in Idaho, Utah, and Nevada have recently started carrying the blood. But across the country, very few agencies do. Keeping the blood fresh is a daily task. James Levi runs EMS for another Summit County agency.
They're in ready-to-go coolers that are conditioned every day to keep that temperature between 1 and 6 degrees Celsius the entire time.
He says the blood expires in about a month, so they need a steady supply. Setting up these programs is expensive. but the federal government is starting to invest, dedicating $80 million to pre-hospital blood programs, with more grants on the way. Jonathan Morrison leads the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration.
Ideally, I think this would just be a standard part of the trauma treatment for crash victims or other trauma victims.
He points out that more than 40% of people who die in car crashes are still alive when first responders arrive, meaning there's a window to act. Summit County, Colorado is seeing results. Ridenour says her first patient recovered well at the hospital.
For me, it was kind of one of the coolest things that I've been able to do in my career, and I've been privileged to work this job for a long time.
She says it's a gift to be able to carry whole blood and to know she can make a difference. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Rachel Cohen.
Earlier this year, the Clark County Fire Department's EMS-18 response vehicle was outfitted to administer whole blood to patients on the scene. It's the first emergency response vehicle in the state to offer whole blood transfusions. The program is part of a Southern Nevada Health Department-approved trial, the long-term goal of which is to expand whole blood availability across the entire Las Vegas Valley. Probably heard at least one news story about this year's Consumer Electronics Show, or CES, in Las Vegas. And it was probably covering the extensive implementation of AI in the products that were being exhibited. But something else was going on at the exhibit. Something much more important to Nevada's economy. It was the first show hosted in the Las Vegas Convention Center's complete $600 million expansion and renovation. After being talked about for many years, that center's expansion and renovation got underway in 2021. The new West Hall opened in the same year, and by the time CES opened in January, the Legacy Campus was completed as well. The center now offers a total of 4.6 million square feet of meeting and exhibit space, the largest trade show in the U.S. The construction industry's ConExpo took place there in March. So what does the massive project mean to the city and the region? KNPR's Heidi Kaiser recently put that question to Vanessa Claspel, Chief Sales Officer for the Las Vegas Convention and Visitors Authority, Nancy Droppo, the Vice President of Research for the Center for Exhibition Industry Research, and Lori Duquette, a Las Vegas-based account executive for the Expo Group. Here's that conversation.
Vanessa, Nancy, and Lori, thank you so much for talking with me.
Thank you.
Vanessa, I want to start with you. You've been an executive with the Las Vegas Convention and Visitors Authority for going on a year now, coming from a Fairfax, Virginia-based hotel company. We'll get into the numbers in a moment, but just broadly speaking, what was your reaction when you saw the new Las Vegas Convention Center for the first time?
Incredible. It's not often that you see a city who has the means and the ability to invest in its infrastructure the way Las Vegas does. There is no doubt that this is really an exercise and an exhibition, right, of just what happens in Vegas from a scale, from the ambition and evolution of this city. So I would say the wow was quite evident for me coming into this role.
So we heard a few numbers about the convention center's expansion and renovation in the introduction, but let's zoom out a little bit. The convention center previously had more than 3 million square feet of exhibit space. That's those big warehouse-like rooms where companies set up their booths for a trade show, and something like 225 meeting rooms. How much and how many does it have now of each of those?
What I'd like to say really probably more on that is with the expansion, really what we were able to do is finally be able to have concurrent events in the building, where during renovation, we didn't have that. And a great example of that is to be able to have World of Concrete happen in 3/4 of the campus and heating and air happen in another portion of the campus. And all of a sudden we're compressing and maximizing every bit of the center. But what that really means is we're compressing and really creating demand throughout the city of Las Vegas. And so that means that we're filling hotel rooms. We're really making sure that we are thinking about Sunday through Thursday, when every one of our resort partners really need us to bring in meetings and events customers.
And that's due to the multiple halls. You have West Hall, North Hall, South Hall. But so what is the total of exhibit space available then right now?
Right. So we've got 2.5 million of usable square footage of exhibit space throughout the campus now that we're completed with the renovation.
Nancy, I want to bring you in here to put what Vanessa's saying in some perspective. Your organization tracks the size of gatherings that take place in those convention centers, so the business being done there, let's say. How does the number and size of Las Vegas trade shows compare to those in other top destinations?
I'm going to first cite data from Trade Show Executive. They are the entity that tracks space on a per venue basis. They track 291 venues in North America. And in terms of competitors, in terms of volume of space, you're up against McCormick, right? In Chicago, they've got 2.6 million prime space. So, I mean, you two are like above everybody else. Number three is Orange County, you know, in Florida, Orlando. Las Vegas is premier in terms of strategy. And so, you know, space looking to have more than one event happening on location, because there's only a handful of shows that need over 1 million net square feet of paid space. We track events that are 200,000 net square feet of space or larger. That too is an elite group. Many shows are smaller than that. So, right, Vanessa, you're out there trying to get multiple shows in to keep
We are, you know, and I think to add to that is, you know, for the calendar year of 2026, we will have over 46 of these large trade show conventions here in the building, which, you know, historically we've been number one. You know, when you look at last year, we hosted more trade shows than yes. Chicago, Orlando, San Francisco, and others. We really are the number one capital for this kind of business, which again really speaks to why it was so important that we do that renovation, we do that expansion, that thought of how do we support those 150,000 hotel rooms from all of our resorts in this destination.
And Nancy, coming back to some of the statistics that your organization tracks, how do those other numbers that Vanessa cited, the 150,000 hotel rooms, the 46 major events, how do those numbers stack up against those other top destinations of Chicago, Orlando?
This is a tally top 50 cities as quantified in last time the census was done. So it was published in 23, but it's a tally of 2019. And Las Vegas held 716 events. Number two was Orlando, 495. But in this particular census, there was an aggregated dimensional index because volume of events is one measure, but that's square footage, which implies the number of exhibitors, but also attendance. And if you look in terms of that dimensional index, Las Vegas is far above everybody else. It was 100, whereas in this aggregated index, Orlando is number two at 38.
And it is worth noting here that there are other convention centers even within Las Vegas, which is sort of an exception compared to other cities as well, that we have multiple mm-hmm. venues. Vanessa, mm-hmm. there are many technological advances in the new convention center compared to the old one, such as the massive video screen that folks can see from the street driving by. I know there are a bunch. But if you had to narrow it down, what are the top two or three of the big technological advances there?
Well, I would say certainly from when we talk about, you know, in the Central Hall atrium, the fact that we have these three striking digital screens and, you know, really adding this opportunity for show organizers to have one-of-a-kind branding and advertising opportunities. The largest screen measures 75 feet by 42 feet, which is 4.5 times a highway billboard. You know, I would say the other thing is really making sure that we enhanced Wi-Fi capacity, working with our partner with Cox, making sure that that is very seamless, very high speed, really meeting to the need of attendees and trade show exhibitors. And then finally, I would say probably the last thing, while it's not maybe very tech, it's certainly very important, being that we are here in Las Vegas, which is a new climate controlled concourse that connects our north and south halls, which really allows attendees now to move seamlessly between the two halls, but to do so without going outside.
Lori, I want to bring you in here. As we heard, you're an account executive for the Expo Group and you're based in Las Vegas. From your behind the scenes perspective of the people who actually sort of build the events and kind of make them happen, so to speak, how does the convention center's expansion and renovation for you compare to its previous iteration?
Well, one thing I could say, adding on to what Vanessa was saying about the lobby areas, I was also out at NAB and I saw activation right there in the West Lobby that was a real crowd gatherer and attendees were liking it. And then obviously with all of the added space and the improvements, it's an easier move-in for the exhibitors. But at the same time, those exhibitors also need to step up their game because now the facility, the venue is stepped up. So, you know, expectation from the attendee is I need to see the wow inside the exhibit hall as well as the, you know, the wow that I'm getting from just walking into the venue.
When you have a much larger venue like that, it could also come with some unexpected problems. Have you heard anything from your clients this spring about some maybe unintended consequences of that large size, maybe transportation or any back of the house challenges there?
I don't know that it was so much the move in the back of the house, but I think again, the challenges they have is there's more competition because just as Vanessa has said, it's an easy access now from hall to hall. So if an attendee's in West Hall and needs to get over to, you know, Central or North Hall or even South Hall, they're like not saying, I don't want to go outside. I don't want to get over there. They have an easier access to those areas. So it's how do you capture them when they're coming in that particular part of the venue? And how do you get them to spend more time with you?
And Vanessa, we as Las Vegans do hear people who visit us and stay with us because they're going to a trade show or, you know, Uber drivers talk about attendees complaining about transportation within Las Vegas. Does the new center offer any solutions to some of those transportation issues?
Great question. Well, I think that that really speaks to the loop solution that we have. We'll start with on campus. The loop really moves very seamlessly and very quickly. And what the loop project is, you know, it's the underground tunnels where guests are able to move between halls in Teslas and do so in a very quick manner. But then to also think about for that attendee who's wanting to travel off campus, the loop is also now connecting our resort partners as well as the airport. So we're offering more solutions for transportation to really kind of make that an easier and more seamless. And it's all about how do we condense the amount of time that you're traveling between destinations.
Pulling back, your organization, the Las Vegas Convention and Visitors Authority, tracks all kinds of visitor numbers, isolating some, such as convention attendance. So what percentage of people travel to the city versus conventions versus other kinds of individual and business meeting travel?
You know, we'll just use Q1 right now for calendar year of 26. What we really saw was over 2 million attendees traveled into the destination, all for conventions. This really speaks to one of the highest Q1, both occupancy quarters as well as convention quarters, again, coming out of renovation to really be able to speak to how meetings and events really positively impact our cities and our hoteliers. We saw just for the month of March with ConExpo coming into the destination, a 33% increase in just, you know, convention attendance. And what that did overall for the month, you know, had a nearly 2% growth in occupancy really, again, driven by those meetings and convention attendees who came into the destination.
And Nancy, how about the industry itself? Do you track the overall economic impact of the convention industry in the U.S.?
Oh, absolutely. And we're just publishing either today or tomorrow the economic impact. It's on a national level, so we don't have this data on a per city basis. But the contribution to U.S. GDP had gone up to $96 billion for 2025. Before the pandemic, it was like around $101 billion. But what we're seeing is the resilience of our industry in play. To the issue of the data that for economic impact would be a function of what exhibitors and attendees spend in city, right? That's what you care most. It's heads in the beds. It's the issue of food service access, special events off-premise, that sort of thing. The data for attendee direct spend on a national level is just under 27. It's $26.5 billion nationally and 24 direct spend on the exhibitor side of the equation. That wouldn't all be spent in the host city. It's like a $30 billion industry, just those two categories. So it's robust and it's coming back. It's growing.
Mm. So. And we did have folks from SEER on the program during the COVID-19 pandemic, which really hit the meeting and convention industry quite hard. Do you also track employment numbers, how many people the business employs?
We do. Right now, it supports 2.7 million individuals nationally.
And things have been kind of uncertain in the global economy overall. What's your outlook for the convention industry for the next 5 years? Do you expect it to get back up to those pre-pandemic levels?
Well, we track forward. We have a forecast, and that's coming up. So anybody who's in the business, you want to get access to the SEER index. But yes, we're seeing it. Let's be serious. Today, we're living in a very volatile business environment, right? Every day something new happens. And I'm fascinated by the resilience of our economy and our industry, despite the many headwinds that are going on. But we're expecting that the industry overall, you know, it was forecast to fully recover, but with all the different shocks that have happened, it's been pushed out. But we're expecting to be fully recovered as an industry overall in 2028.
And Lori, from your perspective, how is the recovery going? Are general contractors back up to the amount of business they had before the pandemic?
Yes, I think we're seeing good growth. I mean, we as an organization are looking at a strong growth year. But, you know, at the same time, going back to what Nancy said, it's all about affordability. And I deal a lot with the individual exhibitors, the brands that, you know, are the keystones on the floor. And again, they're looking at how do they stand out and still make it affordable and functional for their organization. We have to be a bit more creative, a bit, you know, how do we still do some of what they're asking to do without getting to a point where it's so outrageously priced that they can't afford it.
And yeah. Vanessa, what's your outlook then looking forward to the next year, 5 years, 10 years?
We're fortunate. Right? We were just so fortunate. We recognize that our forecast for the next 5 or 6 years out is gangbusters. And what I mean by that is all of our annuals are committed. And in the process of recontracting, we're bringing in new shows, which is equally important, right? It's important to keep all of your existing, but you got to keep adding new. And so we're able to say that we have added nearly 15 new shows to our calendar going for the future. And so that's positive. So we're feeling very confident in our destination and what we have to offer, whether it be, you know, obviously here at our convention center, or whether it's our partners at Mandalay Bay or Venetian. As a whole, we are all feeling very, very proud and very optimistic as we look forward.
Vanessa Claspill is with the Las Vegas Convention and Visitors Authority. Nancy Drapeau is with the Center for Exhibition Industry Research. And Lori Duquette is with the Expo Group. Vanessa, Nancy, Lori, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
As a note, KNPR's managing editor Heidi Kaiser's husband works in the convention industry, though not with any of the guests on today's show. Thank you. The Las Vegas Philharmonic ended its 2023-2024 season by saying farewell to its longtime music director, Donato Cabrera. This weekend, it ends its 2025-26 season by saying hello to its new one, Ray Hatoda. In 2 months, she'll officially be the first woman and Asian American to hold the position of music director for the Philharmonic. Besides conducting this weekend's finale, she's already put her stamp by shaping the upcoming season, which will feature performances by Ravel's Bolero and the music of Japanese animation institution Studio Ghibli. KNPR's Mike Pravat sat down with Hatoda during her last visit to Las Vegas. Here's that conversation.
Ray Hatoda, welcome to Las Vegas and welcome to State of Nevada.
Thank you so much. I'm happy to be here.
We're happy to have you. What led you to seek out the music director position?
I think it was the musicians of the Las Vegas Philharmonic that led me to this position. They are an incredible group, versatile, and just so eager to make music together.
You have performed with them 11 years ago. You performed with them last year as well. I'm sure there was some different players, some, you know, also very much the same. What did you observe in both of their playing and maybe in their spirit that ultimately led you to the decision?
The orchestra 11 years ago was very different, but still, just again, that warmth and that vitality was there. But recently, last May, I conducted a program with them, and the incredible growth that I've heard in just that one concert together was just an inspiring moment. I'm really fascinated with Las Vegas. This is a very unique and special town. I don't think there's a place like this anywhere in the world. And to have a symphonic orchestra that represents Las Vegas, you know, I really wanted to be a part of this momentum.
I'm glad you said that. I wanted to ask you about the uniqueness of this city. You know, anyone knows that there's just a ton of entertainment options in the city. We also have a good handful of other symphony orchestras or other classical ensembles in town. I'm wondering, do you see any of that as a potential challenge?
Actually, no. I believe in the arts, that we collaborate together, when we grow together as a cultural institution. And I know that Las Vegas is the mecca of entertainment. And this is what also drew me to the city, is that there is so much to offer here in the city. And not only the artists that come in, like Beyoncé and Adele and all those wonderful artists in the pop world, but, you know, we get to work with them. And the orchestra has performed with Nas. And to have that sort of collaboration with classical and pop is something that I think is an exciting future in symphonic music, but also that we can play the pillars of the symphonic repertoire.
Yeah, I would say, you know, in all my years of paying attention to music in general here, the audiences definitely have a penchant towards what they recognize. And sometimes they can be a little hesitant with music that they don't. I know, for instance, a lot of the classical organizations in town, they'll play a lot of pops concerts. I'm wondering how you get audiences to be more curious. What is a way of getting them to be more interested in the things that are not always so readily available to them?
Wow, that's a great question, and so many facets to the answer to that. I think one of the things that I'd love to do is build the community around the orchestra. That means featuring local artists, featuring the musicians in the orchestra. I think that's an immediate draw for the community to celebrate their own. And next season, I'm very excited about sharing with you, we are going to feature our concertmaster, Deanne Letourneau, and she will be featured as a soloist, as well as Preston, who is our timpanist. I don't know if you've seen him in the back of the orchestra, but he's a really brilliant young musician, and he will be featured as a soloist as well.
You know, of all the things that could define you as a music director, a conductor, and a pianist, you know, one of the more interesting things is your penchant for both conducting and playing piano simultaneously on stage. You know, I've seen videos where there you are just playing piano in front of the orchestra. And I'm wondering if you could describe what that's like to both play and concentrate on your performance as well as leading the rest of the musicians you're sharing the stage with.
Yes, it's multifaceted. It's like performing on steroids. I have a doctorate in piano performance from the University of Southern California. And it was after I got that doctorate that I got the conducting bug, so to speak. And so I like to marry my two disciplines together. And what better way than to do it with the orchestra, with the Las Vegas Philharmonic. And I appreciate the fact that everyone on stage is working so hard at their craft. It's a crazy brain thing that happens for me, and it takes a lot of work and preparation. And sometimes I think, why am I working so hard? Mm. But I love it, and I love sharing that with the audiences.
You were mentioning the warmth and enthusiasm of the players of the Philharmonic. I'm wondering, is there anything that separates the Las Vegas Philharmonic members from other musicians and orchestras that you've worked with in other cities?
Absolutely. Absolutely. These musicians are so unique and special. I think that they're able to flip on a dime, to play with Nas and be completely engaged with that, and then play a Brahms symphony with so much integrity and power. It's incredible to see the flexibility of these musicians, and you don't see that in very many places.
Now, you're going to be busy with the Phil both behind the podium and offstage as well. You will have your eye on growing the audience and donor support. How have you done that in the past, and do you see where those strategies will work here in Las Vegas?
I think each city is unique in how they do that, and I have to be very sensitive to that, and I am. I'm very aware of what the city's like. I'm the music director of the Fresno Philharmonic, and California in the Central Valley is very different from Las Vegas. So I'm just getting to know the community. It's going to take me some time to get to know all the arts organizations and what other organizations we can collaborate with, because it could be non-art organizations too that we could partner with. And I think there's so many aspects to Las Vegas that it has so much to offer that we can start to explore those partnerships.
When you were chosen to lead the Fresno Philharmonic, you were its first Asian American and first woman music director, and you will have those distinctions at the Las Vegas Philharmonic as well. Your bio emphasizes your steadfast advocacy for marginalized and contemporary American voices, as well as your prioritization of inclusive orchestras and storytelling. I know that you emphasized and led cultural programming in Fresno. I'm wondering, how might you continue that mission of inclusivity here with the Phil?
Yes, it is a deep passion of mine. So I was born in Tokyo, and my family immigrated to the United States when I was 5 years old. I'm a U.S. citizen, but I see the melting pot of our country and how important that reflects in the arts, in our thinking, in our belief systems, and I think it's important to include all of that in what we present on stage. It's wonderful that we have Brahms and Beethoven and Bach, the pillars, again, of our orchestral repertoire, but I love bringing living composers to the forefront and marginalized composers. And, you know, that just influences our art form in such a different way into the 21st century of the symphonic repertoire.
You mentioned the season finale. That'll be this Saturday, and we'll have more information on that concert at KNPR.org. You were talking about Kevin Day, the local composer. You will also be playing works by Mozart and Mussorgsky. I'm wondering if you might feel a little bit of additional pressure because you will be 2 months away from assuming full-time duties of the music director position. For a lot of the people in the audience, some of them have met you, some of them will not have. So do you feel a little bit of extra pressure?
Absolutely not. I feel very much at home in Las Vegas already, and I'm really looking forward to meeting everyone in the audience and sharing this incredible orchestra with all of you and the music that they can do and produce and perform. And I'm really looking forward to next season. We've got some blockbuster concerts that I'm hoping people will be very, very excited about.
As you were programming for this new upcoming season, how did you want to distinguish it from the previous ones, given that you were putting your mark on it?
Yes. So I felt like a kid in a candy store. You know, I get to pick this. I get to pick my M&Ms. I get to, you know, I think that next season will reflect so much of the incredible musicians. Again, I have to bring it back to the music and to the people who make the music on stage. It will really highlight them in a different way. You will hear the standards of the repertoire, but also we end next season with Bolero, Ravel's Bolero. And so you'll hear and notice some familiar music, but then again, featuring two local composers next season as well, Viet Quang, who is Vietnamese, and also Michael Torkey, just a legendary composer nationally, who lives here in Las Vegas. So I'm very, very excited about this.
The Las Vegas Philharmonic performs its season finale this Saturday, May 9th at Reynolds Hall at the Smith Center. I've been speaking with its new music director designate and conductor, Ray Hatoda, who will be leading the orchestra this weekend. And we'll have a link with more information about that show at knpr.org. Ray, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
There's no shortage of what to see, hear, and do at any time in Nevada. Here to filter out a few of the best options is KNPR's Mike Privat, who oversees the Arts and Culture Beat for Nevada Public Radio. Hi, Mike.
Hey, Paul.
Last week, we talked about multiple opera events happening in Southern Nevada, some of them still happening this month. In fact, this week, we've got something different to choose from involving jazz.
We do. I want to start with a free concert called Jazz Underneath the Stars, and that's happening at Centennial Hills Amphitheater on May 8th. Now, we love an outdoor late spring evening concert, and we especially love it when it involves local jazz musicians. And the players on stage will be the Jazz Vegas Orchestra. That's an 18-member big band that's affiliated with the Jazz Outreach Initiative.
With a name like that, sounds like it's on a mission.
Because it is. It's a local nonprofit that's funded by Vegas-born Kenny Rampton. He is a trumpeter for the Jazz at Lincoln Center Orchestra in New York. And the mission of the JOI is to bring more jazz to Las Vegas and beyond. And so they play regular and one-off gigs in town, among other things. And Jazz Underneath the Stars, which, by the way, is co-presented by the City of Las Vegas, will also feature local vocalist Naomi Mauro. So this will not be a purely instrumental concert, you know, for those of you who do like vocal jazz.
And if you can't make that Friday show, looks like there's a Saturday one along the same lines.
Yeah, another free outdoor jazz concert that I think some of the audience has heard of and maybe attended before. And that event is called Jazz in the Park, and it's now in its 36th year. It's also at an amphitheater. This is the one at the Government Center for Clark County, which presents this series every year. And that's happening every Saturday, starting this Saturday, May 9th, and ending June 6th. This Saturday will feature saxophonist Michael Phillips. When I say this man has a history, he has toured and recorded with Prince, Stevie Wonder, and Michael Jackson.
That's a pretty good brag sheet. Does anyone else on the lineup match that resume?
Maybe not with that level of superstar collaboration, but I can tell you that among the series headliners, I would most want to see Marcus Miller. Now, he's performing next week on May 16th, and he's got his own hat trick of legends he's played with, namely Miles Davis, Herbie Hancock, and Wayne Shorter. Now, a final note, you want to get there at 5 p.m. That's the start time. I think the doors open at 4. You want to catch the Las Vegas Academy Jazz Program musicians who open each show. And you can congratulate them as well, because according to their website, they're the recipients of 3 2026 Downbeat Student Music Awards, which means they have now won 29 of those awards to date.
Add the 53 that UNLV has won, and Southern Nevada is churning out some serious talent.
Indeed. Now, here's a bonus. If you can't make either of those, or maybe you don't want to listen to a concert outside, esteemed jazz vocalist Stacey Kent is playing Myron's at the Smith Center on May 8th. And Los Angeles' Jeff Hamilton Trio holds court May 7th through May 9th at Vic's, which is just within walking distance of Myron's at Symphony Park. So yeah, you've got a lot of jazz options this weekend.
You've got Thursday through Saturday covered, but you know what Sunday is, right?
I do. It is Mother's Day, which is a tough day to plan for.
Isn't it considered one of the worst dining out days of the year?
Yes, you clearly know folks in the restaurant and service industry. So let's help them out and forego the usual brunch recommendations.
You know, a tea service can be nice.
You know, I have done that with my own mom in the past, and it's great, but like brunch, it's very crowded. The wait staff's very taxed, and there's not like a ton of options for it. But Paul, you may be onto something here. What about taking in a hands-on tea workshop with mom? Honey Vintage and Bath, that's over at the Wholesome Design Center, is hosting a Mother's Day tea blending workshop. That's at 2 p.m. on the big day, May 10th. An herbalist will walk participants through creating their own custom tea blend with organic and garden-grown herbs. And they're going to learn about flavor profiles and the medicinal value of the herbs they're working with. And as a bonus, Honey Vintage will provide snacks and beverages, too. If you like that, you can book it at their website, and we'll have a link at knpr.org.
I know some moms that will appreciate that over waiting an hour for lunch. Mike, that's all the time we have for this week. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Paul.